And welcome to another edition of the Odyssey Radio Show. I'm your host, Mike Schultz. We talk about mystical and metaphysical topics each week. I try to bring you a very exciting interview, and tonight will be no different. We're going to talk to Richard Bryant tonight from Vancouver, and he's an intuitive and has been reading tarot for years and investigating many metaphysical topics. So we're going to talk about Atlantis tonight and Edgar Cayce and Toth. And a lot of interesting subjects. We're even going to touch on gemstones. So welcome to the show, Richard Bryant.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for inviting me.
Okay, great. Why don't we start with Atlantis? I know that you've researched it for years, and it's a fascinating topic. It appears that there was a large continent in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean that disappeared suddenly many, many years ago. Of course, Plato wrote about it. Why don't you tell us about your research into Atlantis?
Okay, and I'll try to keep it brief, but it's a fascinating subject that I've invested most of my time in researching in the works of Rudolf Steiner and Edgar Cayce. And there's quite a bit of other work about Atlantis, but the most compelling reason to take up the thread there with those two is that they're really unique masters of accessing that information in the Akashic record, where their work about Atlantis has a ring of truth to it and a clarity that's unlike a lot of other channel material. So, and I found a lot that the two of them had written really correlates. So Atlantis, seen from their perspective, is more told through the eyes of the individuals that experience life there and their karmic legacy. Some of the things that we're acting out here today in the Western world are following a very close parallel to what brought about the demise of the Atlantean civilization.
Sure. Do you feel a lot of us are reincarnated from Atlantis?
Oh, quite a few. And in terms of soul age, this is really a fairly common thing for even more recent or contemporary soul age individuals to have Atlantean karma. And there's quite a bit more karmic debt accrued because at the time of the unraveling of the Atlantean civilization, there was a movement into materialism more, and humanity generated a lot of very heavy karmic debt as a result of that, and we're working through that, I believe, right now.
I think we can relate to that.
The Atlantean people, we really can't compare to humans of today. They basically were, it goes so far back that in terms of their evolutionary process and their bodies, they were more telepathic than we were. And their cognitive function was really not developed in the same way, although it doesn't mean they weren't extremely advanced scientifically and spiritually. Did you have a question, Mike?
Oh, absolutely. So tell us a little bit about Atlantean society. What was it like? If you can give us a description, and what types of activities were they involved in?
The Atlantean society was one that was, more time was invested in the good of the order, also the just day-to-day ritual of life, almost like a monastic way of life for a large segment of the population. There was something like a free energy system, which, as you can imagine, just really disengaged them from all the struggle that goes along with controlling energy, because everyone had ample energy that came from a crystalline energy system. So instead of all the stuff that we're embroiled in with oil and fossil fuel, they basically, no one had to compete for that, and this allowed them to advance very rapidly. But part of what happened that went wrong for them was that their abuse of crystalline power, and if we get time, we can talk about the crystalline power system, but the abuse of that power really follows closely the abuse of atomic energy in our age, where we've got something that is on the one hand, it could provide free energy or much energy for everyone and do much to heal humanity and the earth. At the same time, it's terribly tempting for others as a means of control and exploitation. And so what happened evidently, and this is partly from Steiner and from Edgar Cayce, and partly from my spiritual guide, Thoth, there was a splitting off of a faction from within a priest and something like a priest-scientist caste that was in control of the power system. And the abuse of it, the fighting over control of it, resulted in a series of just something similar to like a Chernobyl meltdown. And this evidently took place in an era that was leading up to a polar flip or a reversal of the Earth's polarity.
Okay.
And as they all came together, what happened essentially was not only was it a culture, a little bit like if you could imagine an indigenous people like the Australian Bushmen or the Native Americans vanishing long before any immigrants come, there wouldn't be much of a trace. Well, that's part of it, but also part of it with Atlantis was that this was one of those epic polar reversals where there was shifts in the oceans and in the plates. And this brought about the final undoing of them. And in the meantime, many of them had immigrated because they were knowing that this was going to happen. And one of the immigrations that we know best is the one that landed in the north of India. And these individuals became what everyone refers to as the ancient rishis, or the sages of northern India that were the fathers of the Vedas and the oldest scriptures. But this was this aspect of the Atlantean priesthood that had gotten out before things went sour.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, were these Atlanteans what you believe to be the Anunnaki, or is that a separate group that came from another planet?
Well, now, if I understand what you're saying correctly by the Anunnaki, these are extraterrestrial visitors. Is that correct, Mike?
Right, that intervened in Sumeria and the Middle East and taught advanced knowledge to humans.
Yes, they were no doubt involved in some of the supplying of some specialized crystals and also in providing knowledge used for control. Now, where they held sway or were able to influence was in an area where people were more tempted to abuse the power or the technology that they were giving them. And this was one of the things that was instrumental in their demise.
Now let's talk about the time frame. My research indicates this pole shift occurred about 10,000 BC, which would be the midway point in the Mayan calendar of 25,960 years. What do you think about that?
Well, I think this is a question that I really I'm not able to answer for you in terms of how that relates to the Mayan calendar. But we do know with absolute certainty, in terms of science, there aren't many things that are reproducible or that we can prove. But when you look at the theory of the plate tectonics and the shifting of the land masses, and you see the dovetailing fit of South America and Africa, for instance, you absolutely know that something just cut the mooring line on all the continents, and they went flying all over the continent. And this is pretty drastic. And this does happen with regularity on the Earth, and it's something that if something like that happened then, geologically, it would not have been as severe as the continents moving around, but something like a landmass in Atlantis, it certainly could have sunk. This is where one of the greatest areas of stress in the surface of the Earth occurs, in the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, and that type of stress, that type of motion there. In other words, this would be like the seam that's most likely to give way would be a place where you could lose a landmass or something apart, and it would shift the rest of the continents. So that's a very plausible theory, but I don't have any strong feeling for that one way or another.
Okay, so you say that some of the Atlanteans went to India. What is some of the other areas around the globe where the Atlanteans escaped to?
There was a very strong presence in the British Isles, all through the British Isles, and also through the along the rim of the Mediterranean, and all the points inland from those bodies of water, because what they were able to do, like some of the ancient navigators that made their way to the U.S. long before Christopher Columbus, is they would just keep land in sight and work their way along the coast, and they knew where they had to bridge a gulf or a gap between islands, but they could pretty much work their way from landfall to landfall for very long distances. And That's what quite a few of them did and had been doing because of trade for some time. So this was something where there already was a de facto exodus, but it was by means of trade and the fact that they were very good seamen.
Now, did they live longer than humans, and what did they look like?
The lifespan, from our context of perception, would have been much longer in terms of their appearance. If someone really was interested in looking at a fossil or a human skeletal remains, something that would come fairly close to the predecessors of the Atlanteans would be the Kennewick man that was found near Kennewick in the Columbia River a few years ago. You remember that? It was a big controversy about the possession of the skeletal remains of what was at first believed to be a Native American. And then once the universities got a hold of it, they kind of freaked out because they figured they had something they couldn't explain. And someone way late in the game figured out that the closest thing that they could pin that on to or tie it to genetically as another human was a really strange, anomalous race on one of the small Japanese islands that is fair skin. And this would be the transitional genotype between the Lemurian and Atlantean epoch, and looked very much like us and more like Eurasian or Northern European and Asian people.
I see. So after this disaster occurred, would you say a very small percentage of them survived and were able to regroup? What percentage would you say?
Well, I think that there were a series of things that went wrong over a long period of time. And I think the final episode, from the way we're looking at it now, would have been where the nuclear seat of power for the group that was abusing this particular type of energy finally went under the waves. And, you know, there's a very plausible theory about the landmass of Greenland and the thick ice sheet on it, and how that makes perfect sense for the way that could transport from where it might have been in the Atlantic to that place and stop there in something that was a minor episode of the flip of the polarity of the globe. So that's also a plausible theory that particular landmass may have moved, but it turned into an ice age or put them into a climate change where they had to leave. So it was a gradual thing in some sense.
So if there are long-lost castles and relics of Atlantis, would they be in the middle of the Atlantic? Or I know in the late 60s in Bimini, off the coast of the Caribbean, they did find some roads and areas that could possibly be Atlantis. Where do you think it would be?
Well, that's a really good example of what Edgar Cayce talked about. And for those that are listening that don't know who Edgar Cayce was, he was an American seer and mystic and deeply religious Christian who at some point in his life realized that he needed to just take time out from his day and answer spiritual questions or get guidance from people. A lot of it came directly from his visits to the Akashic Record, or what we would call something more like a trance channel today. And Edgar had his work of these what he called life readings correlated. There were thousands of them that were left in an archive. And somebody went through and extracted all the information about Atlantis, and it's in several books under several different titles. But one of the things that he predicted, even very close to the year, was the emergence of the temple remains in Bimini. And one of the reasons that area is brought to light, I believe, is because that truly was near the nexus of what was one of the final remnants, because that is on something that's very real. The Bermuda Triangle, it's a seat of Earth energies that was part of what they tapped into, that was, imagine like the switching central for a massive electrical system or crystal power system. That was it. And it was sited there because of this strange gravity reversal and other types of energies that are present in that Bermuda Triangle area.
But that was a pretty amazing prediction to be that accurate. It was Bimini in 1968.
Yeah, Edgar Cayce is just really unique and has a credibility that's almost like anyone else. And plus, he established a record over many decades where people in his rural hometown at first and then finally all over the U.S. would send him letters and say, Mr. Casey, I have emphysema. What should I do? And he would lie down on the couch and loosen his tie, and the stenographer would take shorthand, and he would reel off a treatment plan of home remedies that were accessible to the people that or refer them to a chiropractor, a physician, whatever it was. And he got remarkable results. So he's banked this record of just healing people at a distance from psychometry, sometimes not even opening the letters. That's pretty awesome. Rudolf Steiner is another one that, for people that are interested in Atlantis and the occult history and evolution of humanity, that's a good place to look. But he's not a real easy read, but the work is highly recommended.
Now, I'm not familiar with Rudolf Steiner. Why don't you tell me where he's getting his information on Atlantis?
Rudolf Steiner was a tremendously gifted child in terms of his integrity and his intuition. And at one point, he rejected completely when he was reaching his 20s. He rejected all of his intuitive process because he wanted to be more analytical and absolutely be certain that he was not duping himself. And so he went through a long period where he didn't work with it, and finally he reintegrated it into his kind of a scientific rationalist approach to mysticism and information gleaned from the Akashic records. And he would visit the Akash and retrieve information and then record it, and he's left something crazy like 5,000 lectures and dozens of books, and then spawned a whole genre of really excellent spiritual books written by people that he influenced. So a lot of what he has to say about Atlantis is pivotal in understanding what humanity is moving through in this real long-term deep time look at the history of our evolution. It takes us back to Lemuria and what is Atlantean karma about. So it's pretty comprehensive.
So Steiner and Edgar Cayce were highly evolved souls who were able to go to the Akashic records, take those records out, and bring them to humanity then.
That's exactly right, yeah. And they're very good at it.
Okay, I want to talk about Thoth. My research indicates that the Anunnaki, there were many different demigods at the time of Egypt and the mystery schools about 3000 BC, and Thoth was one of their main gods, and he was the scribe. He wrote down all of the secrets and the goings-on of society. Why don't you talk about him and what he has written about Atlantis?
Well, Atlantis and Thoth, or Thoth, as I understand the name, he goes by many names in Tahuti or something like that is the Egyptian way of saying it. There's much about him that takes place outside of the context of Egypt, too, surprisingly. He's one of those individuals or masters that's had many incarnations, and we also could know him by the name of Enoch or Merlin or Quetzalcoatl and others. So he's a being that re-enters with some regularity the earth plane. This is something that looks like this epic journey of Vishnu and his numerous incarnations where he goes through this perfection within the challenges of the earth plane, and every time he has a tremendous impact on humanity and helps them very much. And he's an energy that is there for anyone that wants to connect to that, and all it really takes is, well, I wouldn't want to presume to speak for anyone else in terms of their spiritual work and guidance, but let's just say that energy is there for anyone to connect to in whatever way that they would choose, just like it is with any master.
Sure. Now, is he being channeled today by any particular person, or?
Oh, yes, by many, and this would be a similar phenomenon to, say, many people all over the face of the earth speaking with great credibility and bringing through important information from other ascended masters or Mary Magdalene or whomever. So many people receive information from Thoth, and, you know, Drunvalo Melchizedek would be a good example, who went through a long period almost like being apprenticed to Thoth. And there there, many that are influenced by them. In fact, you could go so far as saying, if you look at esoteric process in the collective humanity, especially in Western world esotericism, what we call hermeticism, or the old mysteries around the alchemy, the magic, the understanding of oracles and divination, all of this that falls under the general heading of hermeticism. Hermes is just another name for both. Much of the arcane wisdom or the hidden wisdom that is associated with the great library of Alexandria was embodied in this one being, and much that was taken and kind of safeguarded with an oral history and not shared outside the family, things like tarot, for instance, and arcane subjects from the mysteries. When Egypt deteriorated, it basically didn't mean that that stopped. It just sort of went underground, and it emerged in Europe as alchemy, Rosicrucian, hermeticism, things like that.
Sure. I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to the Odyssey Radio Show, and we're with Richard Bryant. Are you available by phone, or do you have a website if people want to contact you?
Yeah, I've got a website. I'll need to spell it for you.
Okay.
This website is adinfinitum.org, and that's spelled A-D-I-N-F-I-N-I-T-U-M. .org. So it's adinfinitum.org, and they can link to my email from the website if they want to shoot me an email or ask a question, or if they feel like we need to check in on the phone, they can send their phone number.
Sure, if they want a reading or what have you.
Right, I'd be glad to talk.
Okay, well, let's move on. So as far as Toth, what did he? What was the great lesson of Atlantis? What did he say about it and its destruction?
That people that are in a place of power, there are many things, that the structure of the power system, there is ultimately an aspect of the human process more than it is something unique to politics, where it's just the basic failings of human nature that within a venue, say like politics or a certain sport or a certain profession, there's going to be a certain nuclear group that forms within a larger group that is going to be polarized in a counterproductive way. It's just the way human systems seem to work. And this is one of the things that he addresses in the Emerald Tablet, the way of knowing self, so that this doesn't become a need for humans, a need to take control of something like a power system and to impose their will or control on others. So besides the Emerald Tablet, some of the books that he's left in a somewhat cryptic, kind of a rambling prose, spiritual writings or scriptures, if you will. There's also one of the things that's referred to as the Book of Thoth that we know is the Tarot. And it's believed that there were so many different languages spoken by the scholars that converged on the Great Library at Alexandria that they needed some type of a pictorial representation of what they were talking about that embodied or encompassed all the human experience so that they could show the pictures to each other so that they could help each other translate books, which I guess in tablets that were in many, many different languages in the library. And this was an expedient to communication. It was a codification of all these different rites of passage and parts of the soul's journey that were really distilled.
So the tarot is a pictorial of the universal experience for different cultures and different languages, then?
Absolutely. And the 22 cards of the major arcana were illustrations that were either painted on the wall or in tapestries in the temples of the mystery teachings, and they showed 11 sets of a yin and yang relationship, or the good and the bad side of a coin in terms of like 11 sets of polarized pairs being the 22 total cards, and this was something that was a means of instruction in a symbolic way to the mystery initiates.
Right. You touched on the Emerald Tablet. I actually touch on it in my second DVD, The Temples of Stone. And according to my research, it was actually on display in Egypt. You could go and view this tablet, which includes the famous phrase, as above, so below. And why don't you talk about what that phrase that means?
Well, it's very interesting that you mentioned that. I wasn't aware that that was ever in a place where someone could view it or knew about it. But one of the things that truly is amazing to me is an account that comes down through, I can't remember his name right now, but the source was describing how when the Emerald Tablets were first seen by mortals, it looked like the Hebrew flame letters were like scintillating with something like black fire, which meant it was just so intense, it was just like overwhelming. And so one of the things that those have told me about the Emerald Tablets that would cause them to do strange things like that is because what is contained in the writings on the true this etheric template that we call the Emerald Tablets, it is a way that there's a converging and entering into the earth plane spiritual energies through the waveguides of these letters that are on the Emerald Tablet, the crystalline matrix. It is rather like a crop circle that's conducting an energy that's from a higher octave down into a denser plane, and the nexus, or the place where the plug goes in the wall, gets very hot. And he said, it is really, it is a true thing that they did exist, and I guess the originals had been lost or destroyed for a long time.
My understanding is that the Romans and the church were burning a lot of these artifacts, and that they buried it near the pyramid somewhere, and it may still be there.
I think there may be one that I don't know about the second one or the condition, but I do know that there undoubtedly, this was like a Rosetta Stone or something very important where copies were made, just like the
exactly.
You know, there's a special order within the rabbis called the Sofraim, which means the writers of the book, and it was their sacred job to copy the pages of the book or the law, the Book of Moses. And so this was something that probably, you know, the Emerald Tablet probably exists somewhere, but it's just not out for people to have contact or access.
Right. I wanted to shift back to Edgar Cayce for a bit. Why don't you talk about what his life readings had to say about reincarnation?
Oh.
And how that's actually how we cycle through the physical and the astral plane.
Edgar really had a lot to say about reincarnation, because many of the readings that he would do for people would take them back to a prior lifetime where they'd had a certain difficulty or life experience that they brought with them as a legacy of cause and effect. And not, we don't want to say karma like it's a punitive boomerang type system, because that's not the way it works at all, according to Edgar, and not as I see it either. It's just a universal cause-effect principle. And he would talk about people in Atlantis and many, many generations removed, and he would always tell them that this was a prior lifetime. So basically everyone that he read for, it would seem, or a very high percentage of them, he talked about them in terms of prior lifetimes, or as though reincarnation were just a given or absolutely accepted. And this is something that probably was deleted during something like one of the times when the various elders of the church convened and edited parts of the Bible, or took out what was in it about reincarnation. But there's some interesting stuff about it that hasn't been deleted. For instance, at one point, one of the disciples asking Yeshua, saying, well, who are you really? Because people say that before you were Elijah. And so, you know, that passage goes. And what they're implying there is, you know, we think you're a reincarnation of Elijah. And so, which, you know, pretty much indicates that that's what they believe, too.
So there's glimpses in the Bible of reincarnation still that survived the editing process.
Yeah, it's open to interpretation. like much, you know, is open to interpretation, you know, because that really is implying that, but there's probably other, I would imagine, that it's been deleted. Any place it shows up, that's the only place I can think of where it shows up, but it has great credibility because of who they're talking to.
So did he talk about people coming to the physical plane with a life script and kind of a dharma or a life purpose in each lifetime?
Yes, and the way he put that in very general terms was that the person's actions, for instance, his own, as someone who worked in Atlantean healing temples, shaping this vector of growth and direction of soul movement during the life journey, even in between incarnations, it was going to take him back into healing in this incarnation where he was in his prime in the 20s and 30s, I guess, and doing the same type of thing, but healing this way over distance. Because a lot of what he wrote about in terms of past life stuff, later in his body of work, he started to delve into his own past life. And there's interesting books about his wife and people around him that were drawn to him to work with him, and how that was all something that played out in his epic story in Egypt, which he details, because he visited that so many times in the Akash that there's quite a bit that's written about his lifetime in Egypt, and he was very much involved in healing and trying to purify genetically the humans, and part of what he was trying to mop up after was genetic experimentation, which was part of Atlantis Gone Terribly Wrong. And that's detailed in several books about Edgar Cayce, one of the good titles is Edgar Cayce on Atlantis.
Right, I remember when Shirley MacLaine wrote that first book, Out on a Limb, that's where she started, with just learning about Edgar Cayce. It's kind of a good place to start.
Yes. Easy read, too. It's and his...
Now,
go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, we have about 10 minutes left, and I wanted to get into gemstones and elixirs. Why don't you talk a little bit about, you know, we always think you have to spend $1,000 on some exotic crystal, but I think there are some more common crystals that are, you know, within our budget and we can use in our own personal lives. Why don't you talk about a few of them?
Okay. Well, first of all, I would agree with that. There are a lot of crystals that you might pass over because they're not like a collector piece or they don't look really perfect. But if you were wanting to work with one, if you just looked and picked them up and held them each for, you know, a short amount of time and just allowed your intuition or your feelings to guide you, you might find that getting something that's very important in terms of a crystal to work with, whether it's for a meditation partner or to use for healing work or for whatever reason, it's pretty inexpensive. Now, crystals really work well, and one of the reasons they work well is because the substance or the energetic milieu or the field that's made up by all the crystals that are in the crust of the earth really is kind of what we're tapping into with our own consciousness. In other words, they're creating this field that preceded us by such a staggering amount of time it's inconceivable. And everything as we know it on Earth is dependent on them, and therefore they're the foundation of, and they're an integral part of everything. In other words, you take sand, and basically that's a rich mineral resource, but you have to have the organic material in that to make soil, and essentially what soil is organic material and minerals, which turns into plants, and which in turn feeds animals and ourselves. And so everything really goes back to this fundamental starting place where all energy systems, including the energy that moves through our consciousness, is founded upon this cornerstone of the energy of the mineral realm or the mineral kingdom. So crystals are very, very important for healing for that reason.
So if a person is meditating, they can, you know, hold something like fluorite or quartz, perhaps, in their hand and manifest something?
Well, the most important thing to remember with a crystal is that it is an adjunct to whatever our intent is and whatever the use of our consciousness is, whether it's for healing or meditating, and that we want to keep in mind that we don't want to give up our power to something like a crystal or an icon, but at the same time, we don't want to be afraid of something helping us, because truly it's something that will amplify the effectiveness of certain types of meditation or healing. And it's very, very healing to use crystals and gym elixirs, which are made kind of like a flower essence, where they're just placed in clear water in the sun for a few hours, and the energy of the crystal permeates the water. And it's very, very healing for someone who's never done this. It's really easy to do. You can just drop a quartz crystal, say, for instance, because that's a very good tonic crystal to make sort of a tonic quartz gym elixir drink. You can put that in a clear glass or a bowl in the window and leave it there for a few hours in the morning and drink that. And it's really, really helpful for you to move energy through your body in the same way that it moves through the crystal structures in your collagen and your skeletal system. So you can do that with any quartz crystal, amethyst, fluorite, pretty much any type of crystal, as long as it's not water soluble or something toxic. It's very easy to do. Gym elixirs are something that, if you want to pursue study of that, I'd really highly recommend a book by a gentleman whose last name was Gurudas, or Gurudas, who wrote a book called Gym Elixirs and Crystal Healing. Excellent book.
So what a person can do is they can take a quartz and charge it with their desire, like let's say they want to get a job at XYZ company, and then put it in the water and the sunlight and charge it with that manifestation?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And there's a really great parallel to that in a Native American tradition of taking a small quartz point that you found or you've had for the purpose or you know it's just right, and when you have something really toxic that you want to let go of emotionally or about your world of feelings, not so much physical, but if there's something that you really want to let go of, you take a small quartz point or crystal, place it in a windowsill where sun is streaming in, because the sunshine is important, and you just let that flow from your body, or you create the intent that that's going to move into your small crystal from your body, and that's going to be an in-between place to get rid of it. And you take that and you throw it into a body of water, or you have a place prepared outside to bury it. And it really works well.
So it could be used to withdraw like an ailment or depression or something like that, and then you maybe throw it in the ocean.
Right. And I just wanted to mention that because it seems like it's the reverse of what you're saying, almost working positively for you, like you want to create the intent for a job or prosperity or whatever. Or if you don't have anything in mind that's specific, you can create the intent for that crystal going in the water, that whatever God, the universe, and your guides know is best for you, that will manifest through that, and you may not know exactly what that is. That's what you want.
That's a great idea. Now, when I go to New Age stores, I notice a lot of them are shaped into like wands. They're like vertical wands. How do you use those on the body?
The idea there is that by elongating the cut or making it symmetrical, you're going to be able to direct the body's chi or the body's vital force or life force. And this is something that can be extended and amplified and really focused through a crystal. Now, to give you an example of how chi is used in other systems of medicine, there are Asian doctors that manipulate chi through their fingertips. And if you can imagine a force field extending 12 to 18 inches off the tips of their fingers, where they're actually using the chi from their fingertips to work inside of a human's body in a non-invasive way. And then you take that principle and stretch it a bit and say, if, instead of moving your chi from your hand as a whole, what if you really concentrated it in like a little laser beam into one of these wands? And that is generally used for pinpointing a very specific area of pain. Whereas if you had someone that had inflammation or achiness in a widespread area like the back or all the kidney area, you might use something that is very rounded or a tumbled crystal that's just been in a tumbler and has an asymmetric but round and a real comfortable shape. That would give you sort of a broader expanse and dispersion of this chi that wants to flow down and off of your hands and wrists. And it's the same type of energy that a lot of the people listening will know about. It's like Reiki energy or healing energy that runs through the hands. But the crystal will actually focus that and intensify it and amp it up.
I see. Well, Richard, this has been a very dynamic metaphysical dialogue, and this is on the permanent archives, so people can hear this again because it's so rich in detail. I think we all have to hear this twice. Why don't you let our audience know one more time how you can do a phone reading, how they can get in touch with you?
Okay. Yeah, thanks for that. My website, adinfinitum.org, or it might be easier to remember, Windermere.com, RichardBryant@Windermere.com, and if you want to contact me by email, that'd be great. If we need to talk by phone, just put your number in the email, and we'll make arrangements to do that. And I guess I'm complete from my side. How about you?
Absolutely. And of course, you know, if they want to purchase a crystal or something, you could advise them in that area.
Oh, sure. I'd be glad to help.
Okay, thanks for coming on, and I'll have to have you back soon. Richard Bryant, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Good night.
Take care. Good night. Okay, he's a really dynamic person with a lot of knowledge in many, many different esoteric areas, and I truly enjoyed that conversation. So now in the last 15 minutes or so, we're going to get into the news. You know, America is such a corporate filtered news zone that we miss out on so many important stories. So I do like to touch on that each week. And then we'll get into ancient monuments and mysteries, my favorite topic. So to tell you a bit more about myself, I'm Mike Schultz. I'm a tarot card reader as well. I do phone readings nationwide. And all of that information, including my DVDs on ancient mysteries, is at my website, fountainsofuse.net. That's fountainsofuse.net. Or just click on Odyssey from the main web page, and you can get there, read my bio, and find out more about me, because I certainly have traveled a long spiritual path. I had a very traditional background. I grew up in the church. I was an altar boy, sang in the choir, and slowly, little by little, have gone on this deep metaphysical path over the years. It's been a very exciting trip. So my bio and the DVDs have a lot of different pictures and photographs, and tonight we're going to talk about Peru, some of the ancient sites there. So my comment on the news this week is that it's really hit rock bottom with the mainstream news coverage of Paris Hilton going to jail. This is absolute rock bottom. It's fine for, of course, entertainment shows to carry this story, but for CNN and Fox and the main networks to be all over this story is truly pathetic. The good news, of course, is that ratings are down, down, down for corporate media, and everybody is switching over to the internet and getting foreign news and all sorts of dynamic sources. I'm going to give out a few websites where you can really get the important news of what's really going on each week. And like WorldNet Daily is a good one, worldnetdaily.com. Newswithviews.com is a good one. That's newswithviews.com. And Infowars.com. That's Infowars.com. And David Icke has very good headlines every single day. I go over to DavidIcke.com, and he really covers all the really important issues of the day. And one of the big stories on the internet at Rense.com, R-E-N-S-E.com, is how over the last 20 years we've been outsourcing more and more of our jobs. You know, 30 years ago, you could get a good factory job in the Midwest and make $20 an hour with a high school diploma. Well, it's all leaving. It's all going away. We're having more and more free trade deals, and all of these jobs are, and these factories are relocating to other countries. And we cannot continue to run our nation that way. We cannot keep importing people in and exporting jobs out. That formula doesn't work. So if you go on these websites, WorldNet Daily, and you can really dig into this issue and talk to your politicians about it, because it's very disturbing. And what we're getting more and more of is low-paid retail jobs. actually, and we don't want to become a country that doesn't manufacture anything. So what, to me, this is the big story of this year or the year before, not something like Paris Hilton. And, you know, they're always going to drag a celebrity into the news, whether it's her this week or Anna Nicole Smith or what have you. The other big story is Ron Paul is kind of the people's candidate. He's doing very well in the polls. He keeps winning polls, and he's an internet phenomenon running for president. And the mainstream media just does not want to cover him. They are really gnashing their teeth on this one. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. He's anti-war. As we all know, war is big business, and a lot of people make money in wars, and he wants to pull the plug on war. So corporate media is not too happy with him, but let's all, you know, check out Ron Paul, and you can go into the Google or Yahoo and type in his name and find out all about him. But he's been a real, he wants to go back to the Constitution, actually, a small government and giving most of the power back to the states is really what he stands for. And that's how our government was originally set up, a very small federal government that really just secured our borders and kind of, you know, ran the highways and bridges and things like that. And most all the other issues were debated on and decided upon at the state level. And that's really what Ron Paul is all about. So check him out. He's running for president and really causing quite a stir because he keeps winning polls on the internet, and then they shut down the polls because they don't want people to see that. So it's almost like we live in two different worlds, you know, if you get your news off of corporate media or if you get it off of the internet. It's two different worlds, actually. And there's a lot of other issues. There's a heavy drought in California, a big water shortage in Los Angeles and Las Vegas, and some really important problems that need to be solved that, you know, our president and Congress should really be dealing with, actually, front and center, and the media should be dealing with front and center. That, like I said, it's just gone off in a different direction. So anyway, for the last segment tonight, we are going to talk about Pumapunku, which is an ancient city in Peru. And now Peru is, it's opposite Brazil, about the midpoint of South America. And this city was built at 13,000 feet above sea level, an extremely uninhabitable area. That's why I don't think it was built strictly by humans or for humans. It's referred to by the Incas and the Mayans as the city of the gods, and they have all of these legends and stories that there used to be another group that came down. They were giants, and they were called the Anunnaki or the custodians or what have you, and they founded this city called Pumapunku. And it's spelled P-U-M-A, like Puma, you know, the jaguar, like the tennis shoe, and Punku, P-U-N-K-U. And I've really been studying the photographs closely of Pumapunku. And there's all of these huge stone monoliths and blocks that have been destroyed. But some of the monoliths, the researchers believe, used to be a pier where there were ships. And it used to be on the shore of Lake Titicaca, which is the highest lake in the world. And they think that because they found lines of calcium and mineral deposits, as you would see in a pier on a seashore. So they found water lines. And they also believe that there used to be temples and ceremonial sites. But what's striking about the stones is how heavy they are. Many of them are 50 tons or 60 tons or 70 tons. And the stone quarry is very far away. In some cases, it's 20 miles away. And if you can imagine getting a group of slaves or humans together at that time to cut them out of a stone quarry and move them 20 miles in that high altitude, you know, it's very difficult to do any kind of physical activity at 13,000 feet. And by the way, the soil is barren up there. It's above the timberline. It's hard to grow anything. So once again, not a likely place that humans would settle. My research indicates that this was a remnant of the Anunnaki, this other group of custodial gods that used to be on the planet, not to be confused with the supreme god of the universe. So in my first DVD, The Sands of Time, I have photographs of this region of Peru and all of the artifacts that were left behind. The DVD is $15. You can buy it at my website, fountainsofyouth.net, and it tells the whole ancient astronaut story, the whole theory. It gets into the whole puzzle with lots of photographs. So if you look at close-ups of these huge stone blocks that have now been kind of destroyed and are just left like little pieces on the ground, you will see what looks like grooves, and it appears that there are drilling marks, and some types of advanced machinery was used to create these blocks if you look at the detail of what's left behind. And the way that they put these blocks together was they carved out like an eye-shaped clamp, in the stone, and then they poured copper into it, and the eye shape of the copper held the two blocks together. Now, this is pretty amazing advanced construction knowledge that was not used anywhere else in South America at that time. And the only other place it's been used is in the pyramids of Egypt. They also used these copper clamps, and over in Cambodia, in Angkor Wat, in that ancient complex. So I believe it's a strong indicator that this Anunnaki group went around the world at different times to different continents, and they left their stamp. They left their unique type of construction. Another thing they did was when they put together their stone walls, they were all these different shapes like a puzzle piece. They weren't all rectangular. Like some would look like octagons and some would look like triangles or circles. But regardless, they would all fit together like a big puzzle piece. And this is very unique architecture. Once again, it wasn't found in the hunter-gatherer societies in South America at that time. But it was found in Easter Island and, once again, these remote sites. And what's interesting about Pumapunku and these ancient cities is that this advanced knowledge appeared very suddenly. And the advanced language and hieroglyphics and art and architecture all appeared suddenly, fully formed. In other words, it's not like the archaeologists found other temples that were smaller and cruder and led up to these large cities being built. It's just that these advanced cities appeared fully formed all of a sudden. There's nothing kind of like leading up to it. And the language appeared fully formed. It wasn't developed over time, or they haven't found remnants of that. So Pumapunku was definitely had some kind of destruction occur to it. It could have been the pole shift that we talked about tonight, and it was destroyed. But all of the heavy blocks are still there. You can still go to Peru and walk amongst them. And if you look closely, once again, you see all kinds of grooves and areas where there's been drilling and the use of a lathe or some type of advanced machinery to polish and smooth these stones. It does not appear that they were chipped out with just kind of the hand tools that were used by primitive tribes of the day. So, you know, each week on Odyssey, I'll tell you a bit more about an ancient site. I like to really dig in and tell you a story or a tale about all of these ancient sites. And I do believe it leads up to a grand puzzle. And there's six, you know, advanced societies that appeared suddenly all around the world. Mohenjo-Daro in India, the Peru region we talked about tonight, and Egypt, and Samaria, and China, and Mexico. So if you put all these together, they have a lot of great similarities. And I do believe that this advanced group, this Anunnaki, was on the planet at that time. And we are talking about 3000 BC to 4000 BC. And they certainly left their mark on the planet at that time. So check out my DVDs, The Sands of Time and The Temples of Stone. And they're at my website, fountainsofyouth.net. Fountainsofyouth.net. So next week, we're going to talk about David Icke. He's appearing in Northern California, a big festival this summer, and we're going to talk all about it next week. And David doesn't do too many live appearances, so this is very special and very important. So go to davidicke.com this week and find out all about him. And read his news headlines, because he really is on point and on the ball and really covering the most important news of the day. Each day on his site, I go to his headlines instead of reading the newspaper anymore. You know, I go right on the web to these cutting-edge websites. And I appreciate you joining me tonight. Please go to my archives and check out all of my shows. I have about 30 now, and this is the last show of the evening, so I'm going to wind it up here, and we're going to go off to some beautiful music. And thank you for joining me on Odyssey. I'll see you every Monday at 8 p.m. Pacific. Thank you, and good night.